Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Boomer and the Vape Show, giving voice to 78 million boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Each day we have a different guest and a different topic. Our guests always have a nugget or two for anyone, regardless of where you are. We hope you enjoy the relaxed conversational style of the show. Nothing fancy, just boomers sitting around the table talking about stuff. Now, here are the Boomer and the Vape, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
And yes, we are the Boomer and the Vape Show on Blog Talk Radio. It's Friday, October 1st, 2010, and we're broadcasting from the Boomer and the Vape Enterprises studio in Phoenix, Arizona. We'll be getting to our guests in just a minute. Before we do, I always invite people to go to our website, www.boomerandthebabe.com, sign up for our free online magazine, take a little tour around, see some of the things that we're doing, and start clicking on some of those links and see information about our Boomer Series ebooks and so on and so forth that we publish. So please take time to do that. I am Pete Peters, and Deborah Brown is, I guess, on assignment, as the big-time broadcasters always say. And today our guest is Mr. Matt Bunk. Matt is the managing editor of the Arizona Capital Times. This is Arizona Friday, and this is Arizona Friday talking about politics, and Matt is our politics guru. Welcome to the Boomer and the Babe Show, Matt.
Hey, thanks, Pete. Good to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you as always. We always have a good time when you're here and always have some good conversation. We're right in the throes of this election season now. We're coming down to the short rows, I guess. And we've got a governor that doesn't want to talk to people. We have some Tea Party, I guess you could say that, some Tea Party affiliations here in Arizona. We've got just all kinds of stuff that we can talk to. We've got an attorney general that is working hard trying to get himself noticed, heard, and listened to. Well, I don't know, where would you like to start? I'll just let you kind of set the agenda. What would you like to jump off into the deep end with?
Well, that's a tough question. I guess I could I'll just kind of give you some breaking news, and it's not completely breaking, but this is fairly new. A couple of months ago, we were going to have the Border Governors Conference here in Phoenix, and this was a big, huge conference. It's a really big deal for Arizona to host this thing. Governors from all over the United States, or at least all over the southwestern United States, and Mexican governors, they were all going to attend and talk about policy and working together. And it's an annual event. Anyway, Arizona was going to host it. SB 1070 came along, and some of the Mexican governors, I think all of them actually, decided to boycott this Arizona event. And what happened was, is since we needed to prepare for it a long time before it occurred, the state had basically is on the hook for a ton of costs. There's payment to the resort that they had to reserve room space with. There was all sorts of preparation costs, and it looks like the state's not going to get paid for it back for any of this stuff now that that governor's conference was canceled. When those Mexican governors decided to boycott the event, it basically Jan Brewer called the thing off, and there was an alternate conference that was held in Santa Fe. But even though Arizona didn't hold the thing, it's still on the hook for almost $200,000, or up to $200,000 in preparation costs for an event that never happened. So that's kind of interesting. It's tough budget times here in Arizona. The government has been cutting and cutting and cutting and trying to save money to balance the budget. And, you know, it's just one of those costs, I guess, of SB 1070.
Well, it certainly seems to have some peripheral expenses, other than the fact that it's now got to be defended in court and so on and so forth. That in and of itself is, I'm sure, not a small chunk of change. And then also the fact now that we lost this governor's conference. In addition to that, it's I think, been pretty well documented that there are other conventions and other room nights and types of things that we've lost as far as revenue and tax revenues, certainly in the state of Arizona since that came to pass. And correct me if I'm wrong in this assumption that isn't it the case that it just doesn't, it seems to be worth it to Governor Brewer, and she seems to think that that's all just the cost of doing business and making sure that this this bill is passed.
Well, that's true, and that's where it's been very difficult to try to pinpoint any of the actual losses to the state in terms of economic impact from SB 1070. But this is just one of those that you can directly look at SB 1070, directly look at some of the fallout that occurred afterwards, and say yes, this is money that the state and not just private industry here in Arizona that losing money on the boycotts in small pockets of industry here across the state. This is actually government spending your taxpayers' money on something that never occurred. And the larger thing really might be that Governor Brewer didn't go to this alternate conference that was held in Santa Fe, and many of the governors didn't. Many of the U.S. governors didn't go. Some sent surrogates, though. And our decision, or Brewer's decision to not go to this thing was largely based on, they boycotted our event. This was some alternative event, and we just don't have any reason to go. And, if they boycotted us, why should we have to participate in some other event? So, I mean, we didn't go, and that's, I think, a little bit disappointing as well.
Well,
and yes, sorry, and on you made a much larger point, Pete. I apologize. But yes, SB 1070, there's this legal defense fund. The state, was going to pay for the legal defense, again, taxpayer money to pay for this stuff as SB 1070 goes through the appeals process. But what has occurred now is that people started sending money in all – you probably heard about this. They started sending money in from all over the country to the governor's office to try to help out, just kind of this unsolicited donation drive. And now that fund, after the governor started publicizing it, has $3.6 million in it now. There's some Wisconsin gentleman, I believe, that had put in more than $1 million himself to this fund. So they're going to draw on that, I think, for the legal defense of SB 1070 as they go forward in the defense of this law. But, so that part isn't going to cost the state a whole lot of money, but it is just due to the generosity, I guess, of people wanting to get involved in SB 1070 that this money has just kind of popped out of nowhere for the state to use.
I'm gonna throw this question out there, and maybe you do or don't know the answer, and if you don't, I guess I'm not going to be terribly upset by it. But let's assume, for the sake of the discussion, that all of that fund is not used up. What happens to the money? Do they give it back?
Good question. No, they don't. I'm sure they're not going to give it back. I don't know what they're going to do with it. I'm not sure what exactly the legal parameters are, and I'm sure they're going to try to do something creative. But, this thing is going to be a long, hard-fought battle. We've gotten some attorneys that, I'm not sure what the rate is that the state's paying them, but they are very top-notch attorneys, and typically that comes with a price tag. I would imagine that they're when this is all said and done, that fund, unless it continues to grow, may not have a whole lot left in it at the end of this thing. We've got appeals court processes to go through. We've got, if it goes that far, the Supreme Court, and there's a lot of money that goes into the legal defense in those kinds of situations. So, there may not be a whole lot of money left over after this thing's all said and done anyways, but, people sent these donations in with no specific cause to use that money for, except for, in general, to support SB 1070. So, I'm not exactly sure how creative they want to get with the use of that money, but, who knows.
This is not the first time, and we're going to go back in history, because this is all right now. This is just stream of consciousness with me, Matt. There was a situation when you first started coming on our show a couple of years ago, with regard to English being taught in schools or something like that.
Right, right.
And there was this big brouhaha, and the state of Arizona was defending their position. Was that with Napolitano, or was that with Brewer, or was that pretty much done by the Congress.
Well, or the legislature. Well, that was a whole bunch of people involved. It started, I believe, with Napolitano, and it may actually, I think it started long before Napolitano. It goes back to a case known as Flores v. Arizona, and that predates Napolitano, but it certainly has been going through the courts for years and years and years, and the Supreme Court, dealt with that a little while back, and now it turns out that, and the details on this, I don't have a whole lot of detail on this, I apologize, but yeah, basically the state has not been doing its job in training these English language learner students how to speak English. They haven't been putting the resources, I believe, towards the type of progress that the courts expect to see in these students. I apologize, I'm sitting here talking about English language learner students, and maybe I haven't fully explained what that is, but basically it's a program. Public schools are required to teach students when they have a different first language other than English. And many times it's Hispanic here in Arizona. They're required to take some intensive English classes to try to get brought up to speed with the rest of the of their peers in whatever grade that might be, and so the state is required to pay for those programs, that extra training, and it seems like the state may. And the accusation that the people that support these English language learner programs have been saying for years that the state is not fully funding this stuff to, and then these programs need more money if they want to be successful in it. So it's not a new charge, but now the courts have largely agreed, I think, in. So now the state's probably going to have to figure out a new way to approach that program.
So, but the point I was making is, or was going to be making, is that this is another example of the state of Arizona and the powers that be in the state of Arizona are willing to throw money at these kinds of programs or defend or litigate against or through the federal government. And just throwing the money at it, because, wasn't that the one that Ken Starr was the counsel for?
Yes, I believe that's correct, yeah.
And, he doesn't come cheap, if I remember that conversation.
But I think it was $400 an hour or something like that.
It's
was charging
a ridiculous amount of money. I know you told us, and it was knocked me off the chair. but the point being, the state of Arizona is always willing to fight a battle somewhere, somehow, that ends up costing the taxpayers money. That's my view of it. Is that even close to accurate?
Well, it may in some ways. There's ways of looking at it that what you said is completely accurate. The other way around it, too, is that there's, lawmakers would argue that, the Republican lawmakers here would argue that, we're trying to save taxpayers money by not wasting cash on these kinds of programs more than what they're going to need to use. Let's give them what they need and no more. And their view of what these programs need, it may be different than what the court is looking at, and that seems to be the case. The court may be looking and saying, you need to do more. But these lawmakers are saying, we're trying to do less because we don't want to have the taxpayers fork over all this money for something that, maybe they shouldn't have to be paying for. And so from their perspective, they're saving you money, and that's what they'll tell you. The whole point is to stop throwing money at every problem and maybe try to look at other ways of making the program better without spending money. And that's their MO. So
And correct me if I'm wrong again, please. By all means, tell me I'm full of hot air. But this is all being done primarily by the Republican majority, because the Republicans have been in majority for God knows how many years.
Well, largely, a lot of the education decisions regarding funding and those kinds of things are being driven by those decisions are being driven by Republicans because, like you said, they're in control. That's absolutely correct.
All right, now I'm going to take this down what I think is a logical course here, and you're certainly willing to disagree with me, and if anybody's out there listening to this, they can certainly disagree also. But let's take it one step further in my mind anyhow, and that is, if the Republicans are the ones that are perpetrating these expenditures and trying to cut back on these services and so on and so forth, and then there are people, residents and citizens of the state of Arizona that are saying, we want our services back, we want our services back, we should be having our services, whether they be health care services, unemployment services, education services, whatever they are, highway patrol, whatever it is, police services. And they all want these services. They all don't want to have anything less than what they have enjoyed in the past. And the Republicans are going to cut the services for their own reasons, for their own for their own philosophies. My question then to the voter is, why, if you want X and you're getting Y from your government, how is it and why is it that the Republicans are always still in office if they're not doing what you say you want them to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's
I didn't mean to put you in the spot, Matt, but I mean, this is just a kind of a discussion that I think needs to be had, and nobody wants to go there.
Well, it's so hard to try to understand exactly what voters are thinking. I mean, not just you know, in regards to the issues that you mentioned, but just in general. You know, how do you know? It goes back to answering the question of how we ended up with we've had a huge Republican majority in the legislature for many, many years, and then and it hasn't always been huge, but we have had a Republican majority for many years, and at the same time we were electing Democratic governors. You know, why does that happen? You know, there's a lot of different reasons, and it's just, I feel like it's, I am not capable of completely understanding the decisions of voters. That said, I think that you've got a lot of people down here who, there are a lot of Arizonans who want a slimmer, trimmer government. And so you just get this, you've got this dichotomy of wanting, and it's an attractive thing to want. I mean, who doesn't want, when you think, okay, the government, you know, government waste versus government efficiency. I mean, there's no. I mean, when that's the argument, and that's what the way you see it in your mind. I mean, duh. You know, it's a no-brainer answer. You know, give me a slimmer, more efficient government. But then, when you start to think about the individual issues, okay, what does that mean? That means, you know, paying less on public education. It means getting to the bare minimums in some of these programs. It means cutting people off of Medicaid, and If you're comfortable seeing Arizona schools do the kind of performance standards that they're living up to right now, hey, you know, then government efficiency is your thing. And there are a lot of voters that think that way. But I think there's just people basically, there's a disconnect between, and we saw this with the Prop 100 earlier this year with the sales tax increase. Voters were asked, would you like to pay more taxes in order to fund education and public safety and, you know, these various other services? Voters said, hell yes, we'd love to do that. That's great. And they did it so overwhelmingly that, you know, it's hard to argue with the precedent that they're trying to set there. at the same time, you know, the idea of raising taxes is just an aberration to Republicans here in office. Now, that shows us a supreme disconnect somewhere. But voters, I think, are responsible for their own attitudes, because they're saying we want slimmer government, we want less government waste, we want you to cut spending. But yeah, we do want you to pay more on education. We do want you to pay more for, you know, public safety. Okay, well, you know, I think there's some budget dynamics that voters are not understanding. We have cut our budget down to the bare minimum, federally allowable minimums. The feds will not allow us to cut any more than we've cut in every major program that in our budget. It's not allowed, unless you want to lose, you know, billions and billions of dollars in transportation funding from the feds, healthcare funding from the feds. I mean, the state would actually have almost, if we decided to cut further and the federal government took action, we could end up with almost zero programs at all, and I'm not sure that's what anybody wants. You know, everything would go away. You might not have a health department down here if the federal government stopped sending us Medicaid money. That nobody wants that, but that's where we've cut the budget down to, and That's the problem right now is people, I think many of them, don't understand. Yes, we'd like slimmer government. Okay, do you realize that we're down to the federal minimums on these programs? You know, I think that's where people, I think most people are surprised to hear that second part. And, you know, I think that just leads to the whole thing. Pete, I'm flabbergasted, as you can tell. So I wish I could answer your question, but I'm just, I'm struggling.
Well, how... let me, only from you, on these kinds of conversations, do I hear that kind of discussion as far as, this is the first time I have ever heard anybody say, and now maybe it's because I'm not paying enough attention, but it's the first time I've ever heard anybody say, we're down to federal minimums on these programs. Why is it that that is not a campaign issue?
It has been for some people. It's hard to understand. If you're a voter out here who doesn't pay a lot of attention to politics, I mean, state budgets are not for the weak of heart, man. These things are hard to digest, and there's so many things that are playing into it. Even if you understand the numbers, you might not understand the policy requirements behind the numbers. And it's just hard for a voter to digest all this stuff. I think there are people candidates trying to make that a campaign issue. You know, Republicans last year were trying to tell people over and over again, you know, yes, we'd like to cut more. We don't want to raise taxes. But we don't really know where to cut without, you know, forcing a lawsuit and threatening even more money. And they tried to make that point over and over again. It's just, I think people don't either, they don't believe, you know, they've been hornswoggled by government before. They've heard, well, we can't cut anymore. They've heard this bare bones stuff, you know, we're down to the bare minimums, you know, and everything. You can't expect us to cut more. They've heard that. Government's been asking them to raise taxes based on those arguments for years and years and years. And in many cases, government has been overly, they've maybe gone a little bit overboard in trying to tell voters, you know, if you don't give us this tax increase, we're seriously in trouble. You know, and there's been times where those tax increases then haven't passed, and government somehow finds a way to survive. So voters look at it and they think, well, you told us you weren't going to survive, but look, you did. You found a way to do it. And I think that's what voters have in their head right now, is that, yeah, you're telling us you can't cut anymore, but we don't really believe you. We've heard that before. Well, in this case, and, you know, I've looked at the budget. We understand the budget down here at the Cap Times as well as anybody in the media, and I can tell you firsthand, there is very little left to cut.
No more park and, there, huh?
Well, they sold our state buildings. I mean, they sold the Capitol, the House building, the Senate building, the executive tower. They sold that stuff. It's mortgaged. We owned it. You know, the state owned that stuff a few years ago, and we've owned it for years. We sold a whole slew of buildings for almost $1 billion, and we're buying them back over the next, you know, 30 years or whatever. But that's the depths that we've had to go, you know. And is it a good decision? I personally think that selling those state buildings and buying them back was a very, very poor fiscal decision. You know, we're going to end up paying like something like $2 billion back over with interest, you know what I mean? It's about $2 billion that we're going to end up paying back, and we only got about $730 million for these buildings. So we're paying back twice what we got. It's just that it was a stopgap measure to get through the budget problems that we had the last couple of years.
Well, that's,
you know,
like
taking
a second mortgage on your house.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's what we did. And Republicans that voted for that, I think they know. I think they knew at the time this is a very poor decision. We have no other place to get the money from. You know, and that's just...
Well, I'm certainly... look who we've got. Deborah just popped in from her other assignment. Hello, Deborah.
You make me sound like a witch or something.
No, that's somebody,
that's somebody else.
In Delaware or Connecticut or something.
Well, I have a question. Matt, good morning. How are you?
Hi, Deborah. Good.
Again, you may have been talking about it before I got on, but is there a chart of some kind that could be published that says, here's a particular couple of line items, and here's how close we are to the minimum government standard, and like maybe the next column could be what happens if that goes away because you don't have the government part?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there are ways to chart that. It is very, very complex because what happens is each of the programs within a certain budget line item Like one budget line item may have many, many programs that fall within that, and those programs might be what's regulated by the federal government. So you'd have to look at individual programs that are run by all these different agencies across the state and see where those minimums are at. And it's definitely doable. The JLBC, the Joint Legislative Budget Committee, has tried in some cases to illustrate that. I think it's
time for somebody to illustrate it, so that the good thinking people and the people that care to actually sort through what makes sense. When I said good thinking, I didn't mean it that way. I meant thinking people. I didn't mean good people. so that you can actually see what your issues are all in one spot. You know, it may be complicated for somebody to actually put on one chart, but just pick five things and chart it, you know, so that you can say, okay, this is why this is a problem. This is why we sold the government buildings, the state buildings.
Right. Well, yeah, that I think would probably illustrate it. There's a whole slew of stories that we need to be doing, I think, right now. And I think if you look at the Capital Times over the next couple of months, you'll see some of this stuff come out. But, you know, we're looking at some of the state debt problems that we've got. And, you know, I think our discussion sort of plays into this other aspect of the budget. You know, right now, because of the sale of those buildings, we've increased our debt servicing, which is the amount of money that we pay back for the debts that we've taken out. And it's a yearly cost, this debt servicing. And our debt servicing is now at the point where it's like, I think it's the, oh, geez, I wish I would have looked closer. It's either the fifth or sixth largest line item in our budget now. We education, healthcare, and a few other, you know, agency costs are up there as the highest, the most amount of money that we pay per year. That's where the money goes. But debt servicing is ranked fifth or sixth. I think we're paying back more than $200 million a year just for taking out the debt that we had incurred for the, you know, in previous years. So we are seriously in, our state constitution says we're supposed to incur no more debt than, I think, something like $350,000 a year. We're not allowed to have more than that on the books. And we found ways, creative ways, to get around that over the years. And our debt servicing now is at a point where it's starting to be it's even bigger chunk of our annual, it's taking a bigger chunk of our annual taxes to pay that stuff back.
Right.
Without that debt servicing, that's, what, 200 and some odd million dollars that could go to keep these programs going and maybe go to education and some other things. And, now that we've sold those state buildings, that has increased our debt servicing by 46 million dollars just this year. And then it's going to go up to $65 million in years after that until we pay back this $2 billion that we basically mortgaged all these buildings for. So, yeah, I mean, that's a huge, huge, huge problem. And I don't know right now. I'm looking at it and shaking my head just like these lawmakers. I'm not sure what the answer is.
We need a windfall.
Yeah, we do need a windfall.
A windfall of some kind.
Maybe we can win the Arizona lottery.
Yeah, that might not even do it.
Let me say something. That's why every now and then the fund for the Arizona Highways magazine kind of gets raided, because there's money sitting there, and then, you know, that's Department of Transportation money that's supposed to be for the subscriptions for the magazine, and that gets raided. Same way the education pot gets raided. And then I think these people at the State House are probably they're not evil about it. They're just going, oh, my God, what are we going to do? We got to have some money. And so it's literally robbing Peter to pay Paul.
I don't. It's what they're doing. They're trying to identify priorities, you know, and where, you know, we've only got X amount of money, you know, where do we put it? And, you know, shifting money out of things that they don't feel as important as some of the other core programs. That's how they've balanced the budget in the last couple of years.
Smoke and mirrors.
Continuously doing that, yeah.
Oh, what amazes me is, of course, this is, as we've discussed before, a citizen legislature. Many of these legislators have businesses. They are businessmen and women themselves. And hopefully they're successful businessmen and women. why can't they apply some of their success fundamentals in business to the state of Arizona? Or do they, and they're finding out on a grand scale that their fundamentals don't work?
Well, it's a whole different, you know, sort of ball game. I mean, some people say I know how to run a business, so I know how to run a government. There's other people that'll tell you that running a government is absolutely nothing like running a business. There are, you know, and I think that's what we're seeing right now. People are trying to apply good business practices and good business principles to government budgeting. It's just not the same thing. You know, we're not government just controls the levers of revenue, basically. And, whereas business is stuck to operating based on its profit margin and you know, how much money it's bringing in every year. There's choices that are forced upon businesses that government has some power to leverage. Raising taxes is something that a business would never, you know, obviously you can't just go out there and increase your bottom line. And government has the tendency to do that from time to time. So,
well, when you look at government, and government has expenditures and costs, there's no doubt about it. There's always a cost to government. Where does the revenue for a government come from? How many streams of revenue are there? One is taxes. One is what? I mean, other than taxes, what is it? Whether it's a sales tax, whether it's an income tax, whether it's business taxes, whatever it might be, it's got to be a tax, doesn't it?
I mean,
or if you sell off your buildings,
can...
I mean, you know, that type of thing, but.
Right. I mean, you can do, I mean, there's different things that they will do to avoid calling it a tax. You know what I mean? There's fee increases and different adjustments that they can make to certain rates without calling it a tax increase. But yes, I
measures?
Mean, you know, if we're going to solve any of it, what's that?
I was saying bond measures, maybe some kind of bond measure.
Sure. Yeah, bond measure. I mean, you're typically raising your taxes for a set amount of time with a bond measure, but that would be like a property tax, largely, or something like that. You're looking at right now anything significant, and we're looking at almost $1 billion budget deficit in this fiscal year, the one that we're already in, and then a bigger one next year. It's just never ending. It's been like this for the past 4 years. And to do, I mean, you can't just go around and kind of shore up a few areas and save $1 billion. You know, there's some drastic measures that are going to have to take place, either by cutting and hoping that the federal government doesn't mind that are paying less for these programs than we agreed to, or we raise taxes, raise fees. There's no more buildings really to sell, so we've kind of used up all of our asset liquidation abilities.
Well, let's we spend an awful lot of time on this money thing. That's for darn sure, and it's obviously a very, very big topic of conversation and a very big topic of importance in the state of Arizona, and I'm sure it is in every state, as we know it also is in the federal government. So we've talked about the fact that this is a microcosm of bigger things. But let's talk a little bit about when you and I were kind of preparing to do this show, you had mentioned something about the independents, and they're having some difficulties with proposed election regulations. You want to touch base on that? Tell us what that's all about?
Absolutely. It's kind of fun. I mean, it's not fun if you're an independent, but it's fun to talk about. This is really an interesting situation. You know, this is one of those things where, you know, how politicians will go ahead and make some decisions and then realize later that, holy smokes, we overlooked some really obvious stuff when we passed that. Well, that's sort of what happened with this ballot measure that they've got going on that's going to be on the November 2nd ballot for Arizonans. It's basically the ballot measure. I forget the number. I forget which proposition number it is, but it is the one that is seeking to change the Secretary of State position into a Lieutenant Governor position. And what would happen is that the Lieutenant Governor, based on this ballot measure, if it passes, the Lieutenant Governor would have to run along with the governor on a ticket, like the president and vice president. Right now, voters are not keenly aware that the Secretary of State is the second in command if the governor moves on or dies or something happens. The legislature was trying to set it up so that there wouldn't be this massive shift in philosophy and in policy if the Secretary of State was to ascend. We've had this happen a bunch. Napolitano went on to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Governor Jan Brewer became governor. She was the Secretary of State. The idea is to change this around, make it clear that the Secretary of State, which would be called the Lieutenant Governor, does succeed the governor if the governor moves on. So that was their intention. And the idea was to make sure that there's some seamless transition by allowing the governor and the lieutenant governor to run on as a team. And you'd have to run, you have to be from the same party to run as a team. All right, well, that sort of makes some sense when you think about things in the two-party system, the world of Democrats and Republicans. You'd have a governor, they would choose a running mate. When that governor was elected, that running mate becomes lieutenant governor. Well, the problem is that independents make up 31% of our voters in the state, and possibly even more. It's growing and growing every year. But independents, it's not an official party. They're just independent, as the name suggests. There's no affiliation whatsoever. So this law was written to have the governor and lieutenant governor run as a team, but they have to be from the same party. Well, that totally disenfranchises independents. Basically, they could never run a lieutenant governor candidate. No independent governor or no independent would ever be able to assume the office of lieutenant governor. So independents are really upset, saying you totally forgot about us. We're locked out now, and this is basically lawmakers are saying, oops, you're right. We didn't think about that. So now this ballot measure is out there, could create serious problems for independents, and these guys are having a hard time across the state right now. They're just being forgotten. If you're a 31, voters are 31% independent here in Arizona. Well, you would assume that these independent candidates would be taken pretty seriously, but they're just not gaining much traction. And even when they're going to these debates across the state, where a Republican and Democrat are running for the legislature and there's an independent candidate in that district as well, the independent candidate is being, in some cases, locked out of the debate. The people that are running the debates or hosting the debates are saying, nope, sorry, you're not on the list. And these independents are going, well, I'm on the ballot. Give me a break. I'm on the ballot. Give me a chance to talk. And that's not occurring in some cases. Down in Tucson, we have a guy, Ted Downing, and he's running as an independent. He was a lawmaker before and a Democrat before, and now he's running as an independent. And so he's one of those people that's very, very frustrated and is, trying to raise some awareness of these independent candidates across the state. So it's kind of fun stuff, but if you're an independent right now, you got to be frustrated.
Now, is there an element of that as regards the leader in the clubhouse, so to speak, Jan Brewer, and her failure to want to debate or talk on the same program with the other candidates?
Oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah, I mean, you got some candidates out there trying to get into debates, and then you got other candidates out there, like Brewer, who is desperately trying to avoid debates. And that's exactly, it depends on where you're at. These guys, these independents, are trying to get their name out there because they're sadly behind in the polls. I mean, the independent candidates are just not real viable yet, and for whatever reason. And they're trying to get legitimized in some ways by being a part of these debates. And Governor Brewer is looking at it from a whole different perspective. She's saying, I am so far ahead right now that there is no reason for me to legitimize my opponent who's 20 points behind in the polls or whatever, that number might be right now. And it's politics. I mean, from both sides, it's politics. You'll hear independents or those locked out of debates, Terry Goddard, for instance, saying, you're not giving the voters a chance to hear me out or make a good choice based on which candidate they like the most. You're avoiding these kinds of public forums. Well, that's very, very true, and I think it hurts the state to not be able to see these candidates duke it out and really show you who they are. you know, I guess from a hardcore political strategist standpoint, there's the whole thing of, well, if I'm up by 20 points right now, that means voters, you know, have pretty much shut you out in their minds, and why should I have to legitimize you? I'm clearly the front runner. So there's two kind of arguments going on out there. And
what I think. You know, you ready for what I think?
Absolutely.
I think we should really mess with the heads of the pollsters and start not telling them anything. Don't tell them anything for a couple of cycles. And then you won't have this kind of behavior on the part of anybody anywhere, because they won't be answering to the polls and operating to the polls. They will be operating to what the people need to hear. And you'll go back to stump speeches that make sense. You'll go back to the whistle stop tour that they used to do back in the day, you know, when it was the train and the, you know, I'm talking about a national campaign, obviously, but, you know, where you're getting out and you're actually talking to people. You're not worrying about what the polls say, because what you're saying, you know, this is just ridiculous. That means that nobody's going to be able to hear the other candidates, no matter who they are. That does not make sense.
No, I agree. It's not good for democracy to do this. At all. I mean, the voters need as much information as they can get.
The only people that can change that are the voters. And the voters can change it by not participating in certain elements of this whole thing that, you know, makes this possible. In other words, if we stop watching commercials, we just stop watching the ads, and we just all say, you know what, we're not going to do, I know I'm doing my Pollyanna thing, but, you know, if we all just say, you know what, I don't care what the negative ads or the positive ads are on television, you do not have my permission to spend $150 million on your campaign, Meg Whitman, you know, whomever.
Right.
You know, the whole thing is absurd. And the other thing, I think, you know, looking at the people who are trying to get in and having trouble against more established candidates for whatever reason, look at the things that are happening with the write-in candidates, two of them now, on the national scene, trying to get in because they didn't like the outcome of their particular primaries. That's amazing.
Right.
That is amazing.
Well,
trying to jockey for position, change the rules, and who's sitting left? You know, who's left holding the bag is the public going, wow, this is not what I had in mind.
I agree. I think if people, if they just paid less attention to that, or if they stopped, you know, responding to polls, I think you would get the results that you're talking about. One of the things, though, that drives me nuts, and I have to say this, because this is incumbent on the voters, too. This information that you say, you know, that everybody claims they want, oh, I want to know, you know, all you do is give me sound bites, I see these ads, so I don't really know what anybody stands for. Go do some stinking research. You know, I'm sorry to be upset about this, but you know what? Voters have been apathetic to the point where it is just absolutely sickening. There is information out there. There's lots of information out there. I know because we put it out there, and I know because there's other sources that put it out there. Look at the ads, and then juxtapose what you see on those ads with what these people are really doing behind the scenes. I think that ads are revealing if you know what their issues are. And what bothers me is that nobody goes beyond it. They all say, well, you know, I'm sick and tired of these sound bites. Well, I talk to voters every day. I talk to people, normal people all the time. They don't have the first clue what anybody stands for, even if that information is right out there within one, you know, one mouse click away. And they aren't going to find out what's going on. And they'd rather, and then they sit around and complain because, oh, you give me these polls and you give me this and that and this garbage on TV, these ads, you know, you're just confusing me. Well, it's not confusing if you know the background. If you know who these people are and you see the ads, that's actual information that tells you about their character. And you should be trying to do a little bit of research. Don't rely. Don't do political research by watching TV at 7 o'clock at night and checking out these ads. Go stink and read a newspaper. You know, go to the library and check out some archives. Spend some time on Google searching these candidates. There is information out there on every one of these people. And I don't understand why voters sit around and complain about not understanding these issues when they just don't get involved.
And, it's easier, Matt. It's easier.
That's my concern. And it's
they hear the talking points and they regurgitate the talking points. And I don't care if it's a Republican or a Democrat. It doesn't make a doggone bit of difference. They regurgitate the talking points because that's all the energy they want to devote to it. It's absolutely amazing to me.
This isn't in control. The strategists and the political parties, they're not in control of all of this stuff. They are as much as the voters let them be. And if you're going to sit around on your butt and watch The Simpsons at night instead of learning about what's really going on out there, then you're going to give those people the control of office. You're going to give them control of who's our president, who's our congresspeople, who is our running our legislature, and that's what's going on right now. And if people just got involved and got off their butts, frankly, they wouldn't be so surprised about these people that get elected and come in and make decisions that they didn't think they were going to make. And you know, I have to admit, you know, there were times when I was a journalist before I got into the politics very deeply, that was who I was. I mean, I cared about politics. I obviously do. It's what I do now. I had that passion then, too. But I was just like everybody else. I did my job. I had other things going on. I didn't pay enough attention to politics. And then I went to the ballot and I voted for people, and I sat there and I looked at the names, and I went, I have no idea what this person stands for except for that ad that I saw on TV. You know, that's my fault.
Matt,
you know?
We've got somebody that's posed a couple of questions on the chat page here. I'll just read these up, and Matt, you can respond to it. Arlo says that research is a skill. Many do not have this skill. Where, for example, do you look? And the next thing the same person says is, wouldn't you be serving voters, in quotes, better by educating them instead of complaining about their ignorance? Your response,
well,
Matt?
My response is that that's exactly why I do what I do every day. You know, we put that information out there every day. There's other, and I'm not just talking about us. I'm just as an example, because I know firsthand what we do. We put out, you know, election guides where we have biographical information and issue-based answers from each of the candidates. Hundreds and hundreds of candidates respond to this every year. It's out there. We have it on. We put this information online. There's other groups that do the same thing. There's nonprofit organizations that put out a whole lot of information on how people voted. You know, if you're interested in an issue, type in, you know, to Google the issue that you're interested in. And if you're, you know, interested in where a certain candidate stands on that issue, type in the candidate's name and the issue. And you're going to see stuff come up. Now, some of it's not, you know, this is on the Internet, so some of it's not going to be completely accurate. But you're going to have to, you know, sort through and see what trends you see. There's a whole lot of newspapers reporting right now. And if you're going to, I think that there's, you know, I'm obviously biased, but, you know, there's so many blogs and you know, kind of hacks out there that are just putting out information online. I think people need to go back to reading their newspaper. And I just don't personally subscribe to the idea that everybody in the newspaper industry is biased. I just don't. I've been in this industry for too long. And there are some, you know, some people that lean this way or that way. But, you know, I still think newspapers are the most reliable source of this kind of information. I think people need to go back to that.
Well, what I think it is, and this is my personal opinion, I think people are lazy. They're so used to flopping themselves down on the couch or in the lazy boy in front of the television and listening to the talking heads or listening to the ads, and that's what they take as the gospel, and they don't do the research. And there really is, I agree with you, there really is any number of places that people can go. And in my opinion, it does not take a rocket scientist to figure this out. There is more information available to more people from more sources now than there ever has been before in history, and that includes sources and information about people and their political positions. So, the voters have no one to blame but themselves. They get what they vote for. That's it. They get what they vote for. That's why they have the vote. And if it doesn't work out the way you like it, well then you've got an option. You can change it next time by not voting again for that person. That's really the way this whole thing is supposed to work, as I understand it. It's not a question of taking back my country. It's not a question of taking back my government. It's a question of, to the victor go the spoils, and as long as they're in position, if you don't like them, then vote them out. Doesn't have to be a lot of hard talk rhetoric and a lot of left-wing and right-wing rhetoric. Just go to the polls and vote. Part of the problem is nobody votes, for crying out loud. What do you think the turnout is expected to be for this election in Arizona? Matt, do you have any idea?
Well, it's going to be about probably 40% or something like that, and that's going to be big. I mean, we had 25%. This is exactly what I mean. And we had 25% turnout in the primary election. 25%, and that's not 25% of the population. That's 25% of the people who are registered to vote, which is a fraction of the actual population. So we have a very small fraction of people making decisions for all of us right now. And that's the part that drives me up the wall. People either have checked out because they're upset with government, so they stop paying attention, and then they don't vote, or they get to the ballot box and they don't really know what they're voting for. And not everybody. There are a lot of people that are pretty astute. But I'm not trying to blame voters. I was one of them. I mean, we're busy. We got a million things going on. We got families to raise. We have jobs to do. And I'm fortunate because I'm down here every day and my job corresponds with understanding politics. But I talk to my neighbors. I talk to people in the gym. And it's just, to me, it's baffling how many people just don't care enough to go and do the minimal amount of research that's necessary to understand some of these issues.
Arlo just made another post on the chat line. He said the ads don't seem to be addressing these issues. Just one candidate digging up dirt on the other. He doesn't pay attention. Well, I'm going to say to you, Arlo, good for you. I agree with that statement wholeheartedly. I'm not going to say what I think it is because I don't want to use that kind of a term here. But it's just plain flat baloney is the nicest way I can say it. I just don't see why they're wasting all this money that they're getting from supporters and lobbyists and whatever else. There's got to be a reason. And the reason, obviously, is they're getting paid somewhere down the line and getting paid handsomely by someone beyond whatever it is. And he says, dirt. And he says, oopsie. Okay. We got you anyhow, Arlo. That's not a problem. Matt, what do you think? The ads on... We're a little off some of our topics today, but it's fun. The ads on TV, I mean, all they are is more propaganda, really, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, to answer the kind of the question that you guys were hashing out a minute ago is that they work, and that's the problem. I mean, I'm as disgusted by the ads as anybody. I'm going to not lie. I'm going to tell you that I enjoy writing about them because, you know, they create some pretty interesting some interesting news fodder. But I will tell you that, yeah, I mean, this being the sole communication to the public, these ads, I mean, it's disgusting. The problem is that it literally works. And there's millions of dollars being spent on this stuff. They're not just kind of throwing it out there. These ads out there hoping that they stick. They know that they stick. They do focus groups before they put the ads out there. They know it's effective. They know it's not. They know if they run a certain number of ads in a certain market, this is the return that they're going to get because certain people are going to vote this way now. It works. I mean, and that goes back to my whole thing. I mean, if voters would just not let this stuff affect them and go and do the real research on these candidates, we'd be all in much better shape. I mean, the reason that they run these ads is because it works. It works on voters, you know.
Well, I think you said one key thing, Matt, and that was they spend a lot of money on these ads. They pay for these ads. And it's just sort of like you pay for whatever you're paying to get your information out. And that's why so many candidates want to avoid the public forums and want to avoid the debates. And even the debates aren't what they used to be. But the fact of the matter, they want to avoid the public forums and they want to avoid being on a dais with a bunch of independent journalists asking them questions because they might be called to task. And then the only thing you get to see is how adept they are at sidestepping the question. But they need to be called to task, and they're not going to be called to task if they hide behind whatever they hide behind. They turn around, they walk away, they don't talk to people, they don't talk to their opponents, they don't have a legitimate conversation or debate with their opponents, and it doesn't turn into a scream fest as it always does. They seem to think the one that talks the loudest gets the most press, gets the most attention, and therefore, as long as their name is spelled right and they can identify the name of the ballot, they get a better chance. And it just absolutely amazes me. And now I'm rambling.
Well, it's an epidemic and it's a problem. And I wholeheartedly agree with, you know, everything that you guys have both said in terms of that people should just tune these ads out. Just to make it clear, I agree. But I'm just looking at it from a strategic standpoint, and you know, we control the destiny of this stuff. It's not these strategists; they're not in control. I just have to emphasize, they're playing to what works with us. And if we sat back, and if we demanded debates, if we demanded not throwing dirt, and if we demanded that if you're going to run an ad that tells us about why you are the person for the job. Don't tell me about why the other guy is crappy. You know, if we demanded that, and if we allowed that to impact our decisions, then that's what they would put out. They are trying to get the biggest bang for their buck. They're not out there trying. I mean, there's a certain percentage of voters who will not vote for people when they run negative ads, and that might be a strategy to pursue as well. But the cost-benefit analysis for these people is they'll run, you know, ads that are not dirty, you know, these kinds of ads that will just tell you why they're great, where they stand on the issues. And then they'll run an ad that's dirty. And the ad that's dirty, that gets them a bigger boost in the election than the ones that they don't run the ones that they run that aren't dirty. You know, we just need to take control of this again and say, you know what, if you're going to throw dirt and that's all you're going to be about, then why would I vote for you? You know, these ads can backfire on people too, and I think that's maybe if we were going to advocate for something, maybe that's what we advocate for.
We've got a little continued conversation going on here with Arlo. I'll just read what he's putting in the chat room. He says it's pathetic third-grade playground bullying with money backing it. They work on sheeple, but unfortunately people are voting emotionally, not rationally. He has a question about the previous topic, and that is, since Arizona has no lieutenant governor position and the Secretary of State fills the absence of the governor, do they run together in the election? I think we kind of covered that, and then the answer is no. And then, or is the Secretary of State a separate office? And I believe the answer to that is yes. Is that correct, Matt?
That's absolutely correct. That's the way it is now. They're trying to, you know, change it just based on, it would still stay, the duties of the Secretary of State would largely be the duties of the lieutenant government, and it would be a separate office. But for election purposes and for political reasons, they would be changing it so that they would have to run as a team in the elections.
And that is a proposition on the ballot for this election, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So do you happen to know what that proposition number is?
You know, you stumped me. I'm sitting here in my office. I could probably go out there and grab a copy
that's
of the
okay.
paper and tell you. But.
That's okay. But there again, that's a little bit of that research. That's some of that research we're talking about. The polls that people follow, like it's the most important thing ever, amaze me in that I'm 10% ahead, 5% ahead, plus or minus 3% margin of error, so on and so forth. Is that something that the politicians are there good? Let's move it this way. Are there good polls in Arizona, or are they just a bunch of hooey?
Well, polls are what they are. They're you know, a snapshot in time. I think what people sometimes misunderstand about polls mostly is that what they're trying to do is they're trying to tell you on November 5th, or excuse me, not November 5th, let's pick a real date, say on August 22nd, here is what, here is what voters are feeling on August 22nd. Well, that doesn't mean that's what they're going to be feeling on August 29th or in September. And those polls, those numbers changing all the time, that's based on all the stuff that we're talking about. It's based on the ads that people are running. It's based on their performance in some debates. It's based on a whole bunch of things. And those numbers can swing up and down. Voters are fickle, and they'll change their minds up until Election Day, and there's a lot of undecided people that really affect these races. And when you see these polls, you'll see, you know, X number for Brewer, X number for Goddard. Here's the number of undecideds. And I think what really happens a lot of times is the polls are fairly accurate. I would think that many of them are. The ones that use proper methodology and are not push polls, and push polls are when they're giving you they're giving you kind of leading information as they're asking you questions. Those ones aside, I think many polls are fairly accurate in Arizona. But when you look at those undecided voters that you see in those poll numbers, those voters can many times. On Election Day, those will change the results in a major way. Those folks will hold out until the last minute and make a decision. And independent voters are the same way. Not just the undecideds, but many independents will kind of, they're liable to change based on the character of a candidate, not so much the party affiliation. And so you'll see a lot of a lot of swing on the day of the vote. To answer the question, I mean, polls are not going to tell you who's going to win, but if you've got a poll, if you have 10 polls from different sources, and they're all telling you that so-and-so is ahead by double digits, that's a pretty good indication that so-and-so really might be ahead by double digits. I think looking at polls individually and trying to determine, you know, the results of an election based on one poll or something like that, I think that's a little dangerous. But I think when you kind of look at the whole picture, they can provide some sort of guidance on who's ahead. You know, but you know, I actually think, you know, Deborah raised a really interesting point. You know, if we stop, you know, responding to these polls, I don't necessarily think polls are good for the democratic process either. I mean, I think they're interesting and I like to see them, but you know, I do think they have negative effects. You know, somebody who's behind 20 points in the polls, their supporters may not come out on election day because they're saying, "Why bother?" And then you get fewer people participating. So I do think there are some negative effects of polls. But you know, being a policy wonk, I love to read about them. But
there was another item that you and I discussed prior to coming on air when we talked about some of the things we might talk about today. I want to shout out to Big Sarge. He just dropped in on the chat line as well. Sarge will have some fun with this. Let's talk about the Tea Party in Arizona. The Arizona Tea Party, does it exist, or is the Republican Party a Tea Party in and of itself in Arizona?
Yeah, this is – we're finally talking about something we said we were going to talk about, Pete.
No, it took a while to get there, didn't it? It was a roundabout tour, that's for sure.
Well, I got riled up about voters. But anyways, yeah, Tea Party, you know, the whole thing in Arizona, I think in each state you're seeing a different kind of – a different way that the Tea Party is affecting elections and affecting, you know, the Republican Party, I guess, in particular. And we've seen across the country, we've seen in certain states, there will be like a Republican-endorsed candidate. The party itself will have endorsed a candidate in the primary. And then they will be running against somebody who claims, you know, that they will also be on the Republican ticket, but they're saying, "I'm a Tea Party candidate." And so what you'll get is, you know, in some cases, that will lead to Republicans basically kind of fighting for the same space as Tea Party candidates. In Arizona, I'm not sure. It's hard to describe, but I think there's always been factions within the Arizona Republican Party. At least for a long time, there have been factions. And there's always been...
Well, excuse
you know,
me, we know that because we know that ourselves because we've discussed the fact that the Republicans cannot agree on anything amongst themselves. They have a majority in the Congress, and they can't get anything done anyhow.
Well, that's, yes, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, exactly, that's what the divide is. It's been, in some cases, the moderate Republicans will have a majority in the legislature, for instance, here in Arizona, and so they'll control the pace and the tone of policy. Other times, it's been the conservatives that are kind of controlling the party. And right now, we've been in kind of the last few years, the conservative wing of the Republican Party has really taken control and taken over a lot of seats in the legislature, and they've got a lot more public backing, I guess. I'm not sure if that's the case or if it's just a perceived public backing, but there is a big push for conservatism in the Republican Party in the last couple of years, and it's translated to more conservatives. And what you're seeing is some of these conservative Republicans hold the same beliefs as a Tea Party candidate would. You know, smaller government, you know, dealing with the nation's debt, you know, kind of reining in, you know, overspending that's gone on. And that's really the central theme of a lot of the Tea Party candidates, and at least from a fiscal perspective. And that's been alive and well in Arizona for a long time. So I'm not sure if that's It's really semantics here in Arizona. There's just sort of we call it something different lately now that there's a Tea Party. That's a movement that's happening. There is now some official Tea Party groups out there. There's the Arizona Tea Party. There's Phoenix Tea Party. There's a whole lot of different groups and associations that are trying to organize as an actual political party, but that usually takes years to accomplish, and there's some standards to get on the ballot as a Tea Party official, an official ballot qualified party. So I'm not sure if we're going to see that or not next, you know, in the next couple of election cycles, but we certainly do have a big chunk of the Republican Party who fits the Tea Party description and who, you know, will vote that way in a similar manner to what the Tea Party candidate would vote. So it's a really strange thing. We don't have quite the same, you know, fight between the Republican Party and the Tea Partiers here in Arizona. It's just kind of more of a an inter-party struggle for definition of what the Republican Party stands for here. So
there's some interesting chat going on here. I just want to read this. I think it's kind of cool. Tea Party is 100% hype. This is from Vorpal Byte, I guess it is. I hope I'm pronouncing the name right. Tea Party is 100% hype. It's a media creation. It's doing nothing to help. Big Sarge says some parts of the country have really great Tea Party organizations, but for the most part, they're hype. He agrees with that statement. The other one says that I think with this is from Arlo again. I think with time and exposure, the Coffee Party will pick up momentum and leave the tea baggers in the dust. I thought that was just wonderful. Tea Party is a buzzword. Hey, take your attention off of Obama. I hear you, Deb. We'll get you to it in just a second. Let's call the Tea Party. Well, I don't want to get into that statement from Vorpal Byte. That's something I don't want to go to, frankly. And what were you going to say, Deborah?
I was going to say I'm wondering if the Tea Party candidates and the Tea Party supporters are aware of what's going on with the budget and the fact that the debt service is such a high number and how that happened. Did not realize that. I've been paying much attention. Just wondering if everybody really realizes signing on to as a conservative kind of, you know, a nod to a conservative and responsible program, when really there are some things that have been happening that are kind of not real clear, and the fact that the budget looks balanced right this second, but it's really not. There's things
right.
Like that. It's like, do the Tea Party people, anybody that supports that as a concept, I mean, I support, you know, fiscal responsibility, but my point is, do you think people really know what they're saying yes to?
Some of them, I think, some maybe don't understand it. You know, for some of the reasons that we mentioned earlier, you know, they've heard government screaming about we can't cut anymore, and they know that that's not true in many cases. You know, and I think they've just been this like crying wolf. You know, they're tired of government coming in and saying how dire the situation is, and don't necessarily believe it, or don't understand it. The other part of it, though, is there are people that do understand that within the Tea Party, and some of them, advocate that, well, we don't need the federal government's help. Let's not even bother with it. What they're trying to do to us is unconstitutional anyways, because they've superseded their own, I mean, they've overreached their own power and authority over the states. And these mandates that they've got for, you know, certain spending minimums, they're ridiculous. They're wrong. They're, you know, basically horning in on our business. And so let's fight them in court. Let's just do what we want to do, see what happens, and set up this battle, because the federal government's wrong, and we need to show them that they're wrong. Now, that's you know, part of their argument, at least, you know, among some people who do understand that situation with the budget here in Arizona. But, you know, I get a little nervous because, you know, the roads I drive on, you know, every day to come to work are funded largely by federal dollars. And I'd really hate to have my roads go to crap. I'm not sure I really want to risk a big, huge fight with the feds and then, you know, try to be avoiding dodging potholes all day long in the freeways because they pulled our highway funding because of our noncompliance. Do they think that far deeply into it? I'm not sure. I really couldn't tell you. They like their roads. I know that. I'm not sure they want to see them go to complete hell, but I you know, they would argue probably that, well, let's let private industry take over the roads. We'll pay tolls and instead of taxes, and, you know, so that's another whole part of the, at least in the Arizona conservative Republican / Tea Party movement. It's a movement towards privatization of a lot of government services that traditionally have been paid for through taxpayer dollars. So it gets complex. They have their reasons, but it's major change. It's complete overhaul of the way that we've looked at some of these government services in the past. And I'm not sure you can...
Yeah, it can be oversimplified. I believe that sometimes we, you know, either side, just you know, you draw this broad brush and you stroke and you say, you know what, that's how it should be. And, well, the way that that ramifies down the line can be pretty horrifying when you get to the end. You go, like you say, there's no roads now because we've done this thing that seemed like a good idea up at A, but when we get to X, it's like, oh, I have roads now, you know. I don't know. It's complicated.
It is. It is. And, you know, the U.S. government has an interest in keeping our freeways, you know, open, you know, just for cross-country transportation, you know, keeping goods and services moving across our freeways, you know. And so there is a government, federal government interest in making sure that we have the kinds of programs and services that, you know, it's not just a, you know, it's not just a what do we need here in Arizona kind of question. I think there are some bigger implications that need to be thought about in terms of what does the country need from Arizona too. And just allowing some of these major things to go away, allowing our roads, if that would be the case, to not, you know, receive federal money and have some maintenance problems. I just think there's a larger picture here than just what's how it affects Arizona. So.
Well, go ahead, Deb.
If we could cut federal government in half and give people the opportunity to have private industry step in and take care of whatever was, you know, left out because of that, that would all be great if we thought that was going to happen. That'd be awesome. But who's going to take that first step towards trying to do that and then hope everything else falls in line? That's why it's so scary.
Well, that's what, you know, it, like you said, it's over, you know, just describing it as, well, let's just let private, you know, industry take over these functions of government. That sounds great. Okay, but, you know, if it works, but how do you get to that point? I mean, it's not just that simple. You can't just turn over roads to, you know, to a private contractor without having thought through how this is going to affect everything from, you know, I mean, if I got to pay a toll to get to work instead of paying taxes, that's going to change my household budget. That's going to change a whole lot of other things that I have to do on a personal level, and that's millions and millions of people here that we're talking about that are going to have to make those same changes. You know, do we know that that's the best way to go right now? Can we guess ahead of time and say this is based on some pilot programs in other states that this is definitely going to work on a wide scale in Arizona? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think there's probably some indications it might, but, you know, do we want to take that risk and go that far and see what happens and kind of roll the dice? I don't know.
Well, Matt, we've got a lot of interesting chat going on that I'm not even going to get in, be able to get to here on the chat line. A lot of people chiming in and talking amongst themselves. It's good to see that. We certainly do appreciate it. We appreciate everybody who's been listening to us as well. It's a good thing that I always plan on 90 minutes, Matt, because we're well beyond the hour. And we've been going down the road here quite a bit today and had a lot of fun doing it. And I want to thank you once again for coming and doing the show with us. And we got to get you on at least one more, maybe two more times before the election and then afterwards. Then maybe we'll just have a marathon session after the election. It's going to be interesting, isn't it? It'll be interesting to see if Terry Gatta can pull himself anywhere close to Governor Brewer and see if he makes kind of a last-minute push and makes the thing a little more competitive anyhow. I think that might be a good thing. So Deborah's already signed off, and I'm going to get us signed off right now. Thanks for joining us today. Matt here again. We're always glad to have you. You've been listening to the Boomer and the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio in Phoenix, Arizona, where we bring good conversation to the world. Today we brought you information and conversation with Matt Bunk, the Arizona Capital Times Managing Editor. You can listen to the Boomer and the Babe Show Monday through Friday at 11 at 9 o'clock. I'm sorry, I got my times wrong. At 10 o'clock right here on Blog Talk, 10 o'clock a.m. on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, we do much more than host a radio show on Blog Talk. We also publish e-books, publish a free online magazine, so please go to theboomerandthebabe.com and subscribe to that free online magazine, Boomer and the Babe Journal, and see everything else that makes up the Boomer and the Babe Enterprises. So to be sure to make the second half of your life the best half of your life, and we will see you again next week. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for chatting, and thanks for listening.
to the Boomer the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversation to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as Pete Peters 47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.